This is the Online Learning Podcast, episode number 77. Are you passionate about lifelong learning? Well, now lifelong learning is available at the click of a mouse. The Online Learning Podcast brings you course creator interviews, free marketing tips, and free course recommendations, as well as exclusive discounts every week. So now it's time to join the 6-Minute Strategist himself, John Colley. Welcome to another edition of the Online Learning Podcast. I'm John Colley, I'm your host, and it's great to have you with me today. In today's conversation, I'm talking to Paul Jenkins, who's a film director and online publisher. And it's fascinating, the stuff that Paul has been up to. We cover the time he did an interview in Bosnia with a Bosnian warlord, and indeed another time when he was directing an interview with Gorbachev. So we cover some quite interesting territory. In the middle of all that, you're going to learn one or two absolute pieces of gold about how to do interviews. Now, I have to say that having done, this is episode 77, having done literally several hundred interviews, well, no, not several hundred, but certainly over 100 interviews in the last couple of years, I'm now finally getting some instruction on it. So I'm sure you're going to be very relieved that that's happening. But I hope you enjoy the interview. Paul's a great, great guy to talk to, and he's got a lot of interesting things to say, and his course is absolutely golden. I've just subscribed for it, so I'm really looking forward to taking advantage of that when I'm away next week. But let's not have any more of me. Let's go across and meet Paul Jenkins. Today, it's my great pleasure to welcome Paul Jenkins to the Online Learning Podcast. Paul is a film director and online publisher and has created a fascinating first course, first of many, I think, on how to do great video interviews for reputation and profit. So we're going to be talking about that. Paul, a very warm welcome to the Online Learning Podcast.
Thank you, John.
It's great to have you. Sorry, I'm interrupting again.
just about to say, good to be here.
No, it's great to have you. Great to have you here. Sorry, I'm getting exuberant. I have to calm down. I'll take some more Valium. I always like to start by getting to know you and learn a little bit more about your background. So perhaps you could just share with us a little bit about what you've been doing, what you do, and how you do it.
Sure. Yeah. Basically, I'm a documentary filmmaker. I've been making films for the last 25 years. The rocky road without film school. It was as an apprentice for about 6 years, going through the researcher assistant producer route. Then got into directing about 16 years ago, and have made about 45 productions so far, I think, as a director. I suppose I became known for heavy-duty investigative documentary films internationally, so making long-form documentary feature films, basically. And, that's been my main kind of day job, if you like. About 2 years ago, I realized that the documentary filmmaking world was, frankly, becoming tougher and tougher in terms of budgets, schedules, timings, and all the rest of it. And that really... it was important to start to understand the online world much, much more deeply. So I basically got into development, developing websites, understanding how to code a bit, looking at transmedia experiences, all of that kind of stuff. Up until a point about 6 or 7 months ago when reality hit, and I realized that without understanding marketing and without being able to basically reach an audience, one was going to go nowhere with that. And so I started to intensively study online marketing, basically. And that's led me down to today.
Very exciting. I mean, I share your vision, because I had a conversation with my partners about 5 years ago about, how we market and the purpose of our website. And I won't bore you with all the details here, but that led me to start a blog and start making videos and start podcasting. Because I think it's such a critical part. And one little facet of information which I heard over the weekend was that apparently this year the online education space is worth about $50 billion, and next year they think it's going to double, which makes it an extremely exciting space to be in. So I understand where you've come from. What prompted you then to create this first course?
Well, I launched basically a Kajabi membership platform about 6 or 7 weeks ago. It's called Perfect Video Pro, which essentially is a membership site for people wanting to develop video skills and video production skills, principally for marketing. And I understood when creating that I really wanted to experiment with different platforms and to understand kind of dynamic feedback on particular concepts, particular ideas. Knowing already about Udemy, I thought, well, hang on a second, this would be a very, very good place to do that, given the amount of traffic going through Udemy, given the kind of quality of many of the courses up there. I thought, okay, this is probably a good space to, frankly, to experiment. And so that led me back to Udemy, I suppose. And, you know, why interviewing? Because it's something I kind of know intimately and felt that I could create a course really quite quickly on.
Yeah, as I said before we started recording, this is episode 77, and I'm about to get some interviewing lessons, which is probably a bit sort of slamming the door after the horse has bolted for everybody. But I'm really looking forward to this. So just give us a quick overview of your course before I try and dig a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, I kind of give the nuts and bolts stuff that you probably could get in film school, or you might be able to get out there online in various shapes and forms in terms of planning, execution, technical aspects, distribution, all that stuff. But I think really what people probably wouldn't get a lot of out there, generally speaking, is the spirit of the interview. It's the art of the interview. It's almost sort of the irreverent stuff about what works well on camera and what doesn't and why. And in terms of basically extracting the magic out of an interviewee, because frankly, you know, you see quite a lot of sort of dull interviews, whether it's on news channels or whether it's on marketing style channels and all the rest of it. And you sort of think, well, hang on a second, you know, we really can do a bit better than that, guys. And so it's really just trying to get into that, drill into that real magical sort of territory that I try to do with the course.
I suppose my first question is there a big difference in these techniques between the video interview and the audio interview?
In the sense of the art of interviewing, I don't think so, frankly. I think I think getting someone to deliver something really interesting, fresh, creative, original, it mirrors both. In terms of, obviously, in terms of technical delivery, I guess it is quite different. Yeah, I mean, there's you know, video and film is a real pain in the butt, to be honest with you. It's a real pain to kind of set everything up and get everything right, basically. And you know, I mean, okay, if you follow certain principles, you can minimize the pain. And I suppose maybe that's what I'm in. I'm in the pain minimization business.
I like that too, yes. I'm also in the 80-20 rule camp. So, you know, right. I'm very happy to get 80% of the result for 20% of the effort, but that's because I'm trying to churn out so much. I mean, you mentioned in one of your course lectures, which actually is on preview, so anybody can go to this and have a look at it, and that's how to choose your interviewee. What's the art of choosing your interviewee? Because I'm you know, spraying around trying to find interesting people all the time, and I haven't really got it down to a science yet. I'm still very much treating it as it's either a dartboard exercise or it's very, very much a subjective art form.
I think, well, I guess I think step one is keep an open mind, because you know, certainly not your interviews, of course, but you know, I look around some of the news product, for example, or you look at some of the marketing stuff or internal communication stuff, and almost inexorably they go for the most senior guy. You know, we're talking about the policy of the company, we have to go to the chief marketing officer or whatever it is, and frankly, that isn't necessarily your best bet. You know, you really do need to find people who communicate well with passion, with enthusiasm. And if that passion and enthusiasm is lacking, it sure as hell is going to show on camera. Yeah, you're going to get a very, very dry result. I mean, I think maybe that is the difference with audio interviews. You can get away with it maybe perhaps a little bit more. I mean, you would know more than I on that. But certainly when it comes to the camera lens, it just hoovers up everything, you know, and you know, a nanosecond of eye contact tells you everything you need to know about the person in front of the camera or the relationship between the interviewer and the interviewee. So, step one is, you know, sort of interviewee casting in terms of looking for some passion, some enthusiasm, some zip. You know, has this guy got a pulse? I mean, that's really, really important. Then it's a question of either sussing out the guy through stuff already out there. I mean, if it's a politician or someone reasonably well known, you may well find some stuff on YouTube that gives you a very good clue as to their, you know, their personality and how they deliver. Or very importantly, doing something that frankly is not done this much, that much these days in the media industry, simply because of pressures of time and budget, which is the pre-interviewing process. You know, you need to hit the phone with this person. You need to get them on the end of a line, check them out a bit. Don't talk them out in terms of all the questions, but suss out really, where are they coming from? You know, what's their passion? Where do they light up? And those pre-interviews, whether you do it by phone or whether you actually literally go and meet the person prior to an interview, is pretty crucial to get a good result.
Mm. Yeah, because, I mean, this is why I like to have the pre-chat, you know, spend a little bit of time trying to get a flavour for my guest and give him a chance to understand where I'm coming from. And because we do this over Skype audio only, I do try and turn the video on Skype to start off with so people can realise just how very ugly I am before they get taken out of their misery when I turn it off again. But let's move on to some of the more sort of esoteric aspects of interviewing. You talk about open questions. What exactly is an open question? And I'm saying this because I think I know what you mean, but I'm not sure I'm doing it.
You know, I think, there's a kind of superficial answer, which is an open question is, you know, who, what, why, where, when, how, and so forth. It's the questions that allow someone to drone on, basically, to speak on, you know, to give you a fuller answer, rather than a closed question, which would invite a yes or no answer or very kind of, you know, clausal answer that's going to basically dry up within 3 seconds. But beyond that, I think a truly open question, there's a philosophical aspect to this, I think, which is it's a question that essentially invites an open-minded, creative space. Now, I hope that doesn't sound sort of too Californian wanky, if you like, but, you know, I'm not going off the deep end here, John, I hope, but, you know, it's basically, it's a question that's phrased in a tone and manner that it's an invitation to share, actually. That's how I would define an open question.
Okay, yeah. And talking of sort of questions and interviews and things, can you give me an example of, a sort of good and a bad, a story of an interview that, no names, no pack drill, but an interview that went really well and why, and then another interview that went disastrously wrong and why that happened?
Yeah, okay, hang on. The brain is going to have to be processing the disaster whilst I talk about the good one. The good one, okay, here's an example. We were in Bosnia, filming in Bosnia in 1999, and we were making a film about the Srebrenica massacre, where several thousand Muslims were massacred within the space of several days. And the guy who was the the Muslim warlord commanding Srebrenica at the time of the Bosnian War, essentially had refused all interviews since the war. And, you know, this guy looked like something out of a Marvel comic. You know, he was built up to the nines, quite a fearsome character called Nasser Oritz. Now, Oritz basically was quite a prominent figure in the northern Bosnian town of Tuzla. And it fell to me to go and meet the guy informally several times to essentially ask him to do an interview, you know, to be interviewed for a film we were making about this massacre. Worth noting also that Oritz had been Milosevic's bodyguard prior to the war. So, you know, go figure that.
Okay, yeah.
But anyway, going on to this guy's cafe and meeting and so forth, he made it perfectly clear that he had absolutely no interest whatsoever in going in front of the camera. Up until the point that I offered to do a kickboxing round with him, at which point he kind of crumbled and said, okay, I'll let you guys film me boxing, but there's no way that I will do an interview. Okay? So those were the terms, basically. Okay. So we pitch up and we film Oritz with his bodyguards basically doing their boxing training.
Oh, I thought you were going to get in the ring with him.
Well, I somehow sidestepped that.
Ah, okay. Sorry.
I think, as I think any reasonable human being would have done.
Yeah.
Basically, I just at a certain moment, I just felt that I was going to go for it. I was going to simply try an interview with this guy. And so I did. You know, I caught a moment in between a bout, and I just started speaking to him. Meanwhile, the director, the wonderful Leslie Wood, had told the cameraman Jerry to grab the camera fast and, you know, get it on the interview. And I just basically started asking him about his experiences during the war. Now, you know, the gym felt absolutely silent. You know, and the tension was unbelievable, to be honest with you. And you could feel that this was a kind of very kind of icy situation, yeah? But, you know, what did Oritz do? Oritz basically locked in eye contact and gave the most extraordinary interview, at the end of which he said, by the way, if you want to use this testimony in the Hague war crimes trial, no problem for me, and I'm prepared to go to the Hague, okay?
Oh, wow.
So I turn around, and I look at my Bosnian interpreter, who by this stage she'd gone white with fear, okay? You know, she said, look, I really must talk to him. I must ask him whether he understands what he's just done. So she did. And Oritz simply said, absolutely, very happy to have done the interview. I actually feel relieved. Please use it. Okay. Now, the reason why I'm telling that story is because I think it illustrates that great interviews are about feeling and sensitivity. And again, I hope I'm not sounding like I'm going off the kind of new agey deep end, but it really is incredibly important to accurately feel the person who one is interacting with particularly in a film interview, I think. And you know, in that case, it absolutely worked, and was an extraordinary moment. And I think that flexibility and that feeling has to feed through, you know, whether an interview is planned or unplanned, as with Oritz, I think it's absolutely critical. Interviews that failed. God, let me think. Well, I've had a few with Japanese historians where I had to basically use matchsticks to keep awake myself. I think doing interviews through interpretation can be incredibly hard, quite seriously. I mean, even if you have a kind of live talkback feature and so forth, you know, it can be very, very hard to actually get any momentum, any real dynamism inside an interview where it's through interpretation. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it depends on the subject and culture and so forth. But certainly I can recall a couple of those where, frankly, I just walked away thinking, you know, where did we just lose 2 hours of our life?
I mean, just looking at your course on the screen now while we're talking, and I see that the emotional connection is one of your lectures, and that's, again, on preview. So just picking up on the points you made about the Oritz interview, if people want to get a better insight into that, they should definitely go and check that out. Because they can get into that without signing up or doing anything. They can just go and watch that video, and they'll learn something, which would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is you've got another lecture here, and I'm training myself through this interview, so I'm taking full advantage here. What is talking out?
Because it's, talking out
and how to avoid is talking out?
Yeah, talking out is quite a good one, because it's particularly prevalent in Hollywood and celebrity interviews these days, because frankly the bloody PR agents for these guys will insist on the questions in advance, right? You know, so and so will only do the interview if you send all the questions in advance, and you may not deviate from the questions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, frankly, this is absolute bullshit, and this is rubbish, because what you will end up with is a dry, lifeless, parroted interview. And frankly, I'd rather send the questions and ask them to turn their webcam on and just collect the result later on in the day. Yeah. I mean, you know, an interview is about a live interaction between two people, not about a kind of pre-prepared, pre-rehearsed, scripted thing. That's different. That's called drama. Yeah. And So that's one thing, but the lesson I try to get across in the course is basically not to give the specific questions ahead of the recorded interview to the interviewee, Because if you do that, there's a very good chance that the interviewee will either literally say, well, you know, I've answered that already. Why should I tell you again? I mean, I have seen that happen. Or the interviewee will basically sound dull and repetitive because their brain has already processed the answer. And that can be the case, you know, either if you give the question, say, informally just before you meet the guy on camera, if you like, or if you've given it, say, in a pre-interview on the phone prior to coming along with the camera, mm-hmm. right? So in my experience and opinion, it's very, very important. You know, you can give the terrain of the interview. You can certainly tick off the points you wish to cover. You can map that out. You can so-called produce the interviewee in those terms. But it's very important not to give the specific kind of question, if you like, that you'd like to give in the interview.
So you've got to keep them on their toes and keep them fresh and keep them thinking.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to do with you, except my segues aren't as good as yours. I hope it doesn't sound like I'm jumping around too much. I mean, the next question we'll ask is you again, you talk in another video about how to get the gold. Now, this is I don't know, if this is going too deep into the magic of your course, then tell me I'm pushing the boundary. But what do you mean by get the gold? And yeah, two and a half minutes, 3 minutes to learn how to do that. How do you do it?
You know, both as an interviewer and perhaps when watching certain interviews in certain films or whatever, you sometimes get that kind of, it's almost sort of chilling or you know, the hairs stand up on the back of your neck, kind of, you know, you suddenly realize that you're getting something really quite remarkable. And it's often the moment when the person who you're interviewing comes to an understanding of something at that moment that they perhaps had never at least articulated until that moment. And that can be truly extraordinary when that happens. And you just know you're getting it. You know, you know you're getting something that when it goes into the final film will just leap off the screen. It will grab the audience and not let them go, you know. And that's now, you know, that's the highest point of an interview. And if you're very lucky, you can have an entire interview like that just, you know, just sings. Realistically, you know, you might get one or two of those moments in any given interview. But it's incredibly important to try to get that, because that is going to be the takeaway in your film, in your production, in whatever you're doing. You know, I mean, whether it's a kind of, you know, it could be a 3-minute video or it could be an hour and a half film, it doesn't matter. If you have some of those nuggets where you can feel that the person is really sharing something very, very special at that moment, then you know you've got it. You've come away, it's job done, you know.
Brilliant.
That's the gold.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever achieved that yet, but I mean, I'm happy to keep trying. you've got a case study. It just says Gorbachev, and that intrigued me. So, I mean, was that an interview you did with Gorbachev, or have you put it forward as a good example of an interview?
It was an interview I directed.
Right.
The person who was conducting the interview is a man called Dmitry Muratov, who is the editor-in-chief of Novaya Gazeta, which arguably is the last independent newspaper left in Russia. And Muratov has known Gorbachev for quite a long time. So I was making a film about the murders of Russian journalists, particularly Russian investigative journalists. Mm-hmm. And which was at times an insanely difficult and dangerous film to make. And part of the film was covering Muratov's newspaper, which Gorbachev supports. So anyway, we filmed Muratov going to talk with Gorbachev about press freedom in Russia and about the landscape, if you like, of the media and journalism in Russia. We turn up with Muratov, we're 8 minutes late. And this was really a bad idea. And as we're coming up in the lift to Gorbachev's office, Muratov is extremely nervous, and he's sort of saying, well, you know, we're 8 minutes late. There's no such thing as an ex-president of the Soviet Union, ex-president of Russia, right? And so we thought, okay, we better fix a radio mic on him and be good to go at the moment we get into the office, right? Well, in fact, what happens is that Gorby and Muratov disappear off into a side room whilst we're setting up in the main room, and the radio mic is still on, and the with a wonderful, and I'll tell you the story publicly for the first time, John. So there you go. You're getting some gold.
Brilliant.
As we're waiting in the main room, my cameraman starts to crack up laughing, and I thought, well, what on earth is going on here? And he said, well, you know, just listen. And basically, in Russian, they have a way of swearing in a very funny way, which is called namatam.
Okay, can it's we kind of very keep it as clean as possible?
Yeah.
I'm going to get delisted by iTunes.
It's very, very, very blue, rich, yeah. Comic language in yeah. Russian. Okay, mm-hmm. And very, very funny. And Gorby was in full tirade. Okay, mm-hmm. And so anyway, a little listen and laugh to that. You know, cue forward 20 minutes. Gorby and Muratov walk into our room, mm-hmm. And Gorbachev looks me straight in the eyes and he says, "Ah, BBCisti." Okay. Yeah. Now, in Russia, the forerunner of the KGB, which Gorbachev used to head, by the way, yeah. was known as the Cheka. Okay, yes, the yeah. Committee for Extraordinary. Okay, and so Chekist meant someone who was a member of the KGB. Mm-hmm. So by looking at me and saying BBCisti, basically Gorbachev is saying, oh, okay, you're the guys from the BBC who are the spies. it was with full humor. Yeah, it was a wonderful moment, particularly because Gorbachev was dressed a little bit like Dr. No, in a kind of, you know, all in black with a black turtleneck, and the only thing he was missing was the white cat. So yeah, you know, it was a crack.
What was he like as a character, Gorbachev? Because I've got a tremendous amount of admiration for him, for what he achieved, you know, and the perestroika and the, you know. I mean, I think he made the best of a bad situation, but he did it in a way that preserved world peace. And so I think I do respect him, but I've never met the man, obviously. It'd be fascinating to get a little insight. I mean, I'm not expecting you to say anything that'll get you put onto his hit list, but what was he like as a man?
Well, you know, I studied Russian and what was then rather quaintly called Soviet studies back in the 1980s, before the Gorbachev, before the Soviet Union fell, if you like, and so my degree was null and void by the time I graduated in 1989, and of course, you know, the man who was basically singularly responsible for that, in fact, was Gorbachev, and so meeting the person who, you know, had essentially inspired, I suppose, a lot of my future career, what was an extraordinary moment. Somehow life came a kind of full circle at that point. He was extremely pleasant, very correct, very courteous, good-humoured, and brave. I say brave because we were talking about something very, very sensitive in that interview, which was the at a time when Khodorkovsky had just been arrested, you know, things were really starting to squeeze and tighten in Russia. There was Gorbachev going on public record, essentially condemning what was going on. Yeah, and speaking in terms of the public reaction as well to what was going on. Now, you know, it's very easy to do this kind of stuff when you're out of the country, but when you're actually, you know, a very intrinsic part of the country, mm-hmm. you know, speaking with that kind of authority. For me, at least, that was something really quite remarkable. And one could absolutely understand why he'd been the leader, because here was a guy who clearly had, you know, an immense amount of steel and was prepared to use it. So, you know, I mean, frankly, a very positive impression.
Yeah, yeah, and very interesting. And it's always fascinating to get insights into people, you know, because you see the public persona. But and I, you know, he must be fairly phenomenal to have ended up doing what he did, and to climb through a system like that. No, absolutely.
Yeah, he had the guts inside the then Politburo to to analyze the figures, to understand that the economy was never going to work in the shape that it was, to understand that fundamental change was necessary, and to get on and do it and carry the people with him. You know, I mean, with hindsight, one can look back and see where he got things wrong, but you know. Frankly, given the context of the times, he did something really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But funny, we have a shared military background, you and I. You didn't pursue it as long as I did, but one of the things when we were studying at Sandhurst that we always calculated was that there's a simple piece of maths which says that every new weapon system basically costs 10 times the cost of its predecessor. And when the Russians were already spending, or the USSR was already spending an immense amount on its defense, you know, the idea that they could spend, go from spending, I think it was 5 or 10%, but those figures will be wrong, but it was something extraordinary. They were certainly outspending GDP-wise as a proportion in excess of America, although obviously America had a hugely larger GDP, so America was spending absolutely more. But this, the maths to me said, well, you know, in 5 to 10 years' time, if they've got to go from spending 5% to spending 50% on GDP, it's not going to happen. So the two scenarios were either global war or some form of, you know, not necessarily meltdown, but some sort of, you know, change in the global balance, because you know, they would have to, you know, make compromises. And you know, fortunately, because they had a lead like Gorbachev, they did that. Let's get off politics. Fascinating to get your insight. What I'd like to talk to you about now, though, is your experience of making the course, and particularly with your background in film. Perhaps a few words of advice for people about, you know, what you learned making online courses, and how you can people can stop falling into maybe some of the pitfalls you found when you started.
Well, I'm going to start with a plug, and the plug is for Udemy. Now, the reason why I want to give this plug is because I can testify that, in my case at least, Udemy forces the instructors to jump through a series of hoops which will improve your course and your teaching technique, full stop. Yeah, it's simply the way that Udemy structures the instructor process that's extremely healthy. And It appears to me that that's actually increased in intensity, if you like, since Udemy launched. So simply from the point of view of an instructor, it's actually a very healthy process. I mean, it can be a bit of a pain in the butt sometimes, I guess, and, you know, a little bit kind of, you know, almost intrusive. But on balance, I think it's an incredibly good thing, especially for the students. The second thing to say is that the instructor community, in my experience, by and large, is incredibly supportive there. They have this thing on Facebook, which is Udemy Studio, 17,000 members, you know, and my experience of that has been that the feedback from various people in there has been really incredibly useful. You know, I mean, it's I go in there several times daily now to check out what's going on. I'm a fundamentally lazy person, and, you know,
I think we all are at heart, but
an extremely lazy guy. When I thought about doing this course, I thought, okay, what's the, and I know a bit about interviewing, but, you know, how to basically dump the knowledge down there and do it in the fastest possible way. So I did a sort of back to front, if you like. Instead of mapping out the course, mapping out the outline, doing all the bullet points and all the rest of it, and then effectively creating the course that way, I actually just turned the camera on and just effectively taught straight to the webcam, broke that up, and then bullet pointed that subsequently. That, to be honest, is probably not the way to do it. You know, I think I probably ought to train myself a bit more to deliver to bullet points. But I think with your
documentary film experience, you can probably do that far better than certainly I could. I mean, I tend to have to be much more organized and have these bullet points, you know, prepared. So I know in my 2 or 3 minute little video exactly what points I'm covering, the order I'm covering them in. I have them side by side with my image on the screen, and that's the style of the presentations I do, although I do jump off the screen, you know, demonstrations, you know, when appropriate. But that acts as my prompt, and I don't have it scripted, I don't have it written down, I just then talk to it.
Yeah.
I do need to have that there. I can't remember 20 points the right order and get them all done. And sometimes I'll have a little side take, you know, I'll have to repeat a point 2 or 3 times, and I just do that in the editing in ScreenFlow afterwards. But I try to do it all in one take and keep it, well, probably trying to, like an interview, trying to keep it fresh and not over rehearsed and stilted. Because I did find when I started scripting very early on and I basically read it out, God, it was dull and lifeless and flat and didn't have any energy and pace. And, you know, so I was just no good at that. Tell me about an interview, a course that you've taken that you've particularly enjoyed by somebody else. I always like to get a plug in for somebody at this point.
Well, the plug's going to be for someone who I imagine that some people, at least listening to your podcast, will know about, Alan Hill. Now, you know, here's a guy who demonstrably has been successful on Udemy. That's clear. And, you know, it's also clear that he dynamically reacts to what people need and are asking, for example, inside the Udemy studio. So he's created a course essentially about how to run a successful Udemy course in terms of things like the strategy behind the course, pricing, to a degree, some copywriting advice in there, some specifics about specific techniques and so forth. Did this course. I probably shouldn't give too much away in terms of what's actually in the course, but suffice to say that it certainly opens eyes when it comes to certain techniques that will help a course position and sell. So that's been very, very useful. But I mean, you know, Udemy is a wonderful repository. I mean, simply put, one can find courses practically about anything, you know, and just very, very impressed in terms of the range of stuff that's in there. I mean, another course I can mention very briefly is Per Emanuelsson's course on concept mapping. You know, here's a guy who has not only created a very, very high quality course, but interestingly, he was adapting and changing the course design very much at the last minute. You know, what he was doing was reaching out to several instructors and asking for really quite detailed feedback. And, you know, I was one of those guys, you know, about every aspect of his course. You know, he was really kind of bullet testing the design of his course prior to it going public, you know. So yeah, I mean, just to say that, you know, it's impressive how some instructors, at least, are really crunching it with the courses.
What's his course called? What's Per's course called? Get your concepts straight. Turn your products into winners.
Exactly. That's it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the one.
All right. And the Alan's course, the one you're referring to, because you got several. I think that's How I Make $4,000 a Week from Udemy Courses and No Filming. So I'd like to turn now and talk to you about the offer that I've extracted from you on your course for the community, because I always try and get a discount out of my guests that the community can benefit from. So what have you got to offer for us today?
Okay, so the offer is basically $19 for your listeners, and which I'm very happy to give. And you know, the course eventually, I'm thinking to put the course up to about $199 eventually. So it's a pretty good offer, I think.
And at the moment, the course is priced at?
The course at the moment is $49. It's very shortly going to go up to $69, then north of that.
Right.
So
okay, so this is a great chance to lock in a great deal. And the coupon code that we're going to use is
OLP19.
That's one of my favourites. So just keep it OLP, and then everybody can find them very easily, and you'll be able to track it in your system. I'll make sure those links are in the show notes, which are at jbdcolley.com/OLP077. This will be episode number 77. The links in the show notes will be affiliate links. If you click on them, you'll be supporting the podcast, and I thank you for that. If you want to bypass the affiliate system, I say this every time, all you have to do, go directly into Udemy, find the course. It'll be easy because you have the course title and everything. And then right below the Buy This Course button, there's a redeem a coupon button. Click on that, put in OLP19, and the good news is that Paul will get 97% of those proceeds. So whichever way you want to do it is absolutely fine, and hopefully you'll benefit from a great course at a great price. Paul, where can people find you if they want to know more about you? I'm sure they will after this fascinating discussion.
Well, the filmmaking side, pauljenkinsfilms.com. I've got a blog I use to put out some kind of video and film tips, which is called 2020.buzz, B-U-Z-Z. It's one of the new top-level domains, basically. Beyond that, I have a video membership site called perfectvideopro.com, which basically is a product creation and video product creation membership site, where I'm putting out bi-monthly coaching webinars. That said, I'm going to be doing a full JV launch of that product towards the end of October and in early November, which will be called digitalvideoacademy.com. So basically, it's a kind of mix of filmmaking stuff and, you know, marketing related membership sites.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I'll make sure there are links to those in the show notes. It's been a huge pleasure to talk to you. Very, very insightful stuff. I think your course looks fantastic, and I'm sure you're going to be very successful with it, and I can't wait to see what else you're going to produce for us in the future. Paul, thank you for being a fabulous guest on the Online Learning Podcast.
Thanks, John. It's been a brilliant interview, and you don't need the course.
You had to say that, and I'll send you the check.
I did. I really did.
Well, my thanks to Paul for that highly engaging discussion. Really a fascinating guy to talk to. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you got a lot from it. The show notes are all at OLP077, so that's jbdcolley.com/OLP077 for episode number 77. A quick word on the coupon code. We had a slight mix-up when we were creating it. The coupon code is OL19, Oscar Lima 19, no P. Unfortunately, with Udemy, once you create a coupon code, you can't edit it, and there was a little bit of a mix-up. So that is the coupon code, and I'll make sure that's reflected in all the show notes. A quick shout out now to a couple of 5-star reviews, which I'm really grateful for. The first is from Hangfired. I love all these handles. 5 stars, amazing content, great variety. He says, or she says, I've been listening to John's podcast for a month or so now, plus heard him speak at the UK Podcasters Conference. His content is deep, his delivery engaging, and the variety is excellent. A different thing 3 times a week, what's not to love? Well, I really appreciate that, and I hope the content mix is entertaining and valuable. The other one is from Mike, musicradiocreative.com. I know that's Mike Russell, so Mike, thank you very much for that. Mike Russell, along with Isabella, his partner, are the creators of UK Pod 14. He gives the show 5 stars. Excellent UK-based online expert. He kindly says, John is one of the podcasting greats here in the UK. He's had some excellent and influential guests on his podcast, including Chris Brogan, Rob Walsh and Chris Ducker. It's full of excellent learning and online marketing tips. Good listen. Mike, really appreciate that sentiment. It's great coming from you, I have to say. So don't forget, if you go to the show notes, there is the opportunity to download my 50 great course discounts on the show notes page, which will give you it's 50 discounts from my interview guests over the previous podcast episodes. And I've tried to pick out the best ones for you across a whole range of topics. So hopefully you'll get some really great value from that. If you do, I'm getting all the order wrong here, aren't I? If you do get a chance to pop over to iTunes, a 5-star review would be much appreciated. It really helps the show. It helps the show to grow, and it helps people to find the show. So I suppose that's the same thing, but it would be really helpful, and I'd much appreciate it if you could do it. So that's it for this episode. I really appreciate the time we've had together today. I know how valuable your time is, and I really love it when you can spare some of it to spend it with me. But I look forward to seeing you very soon in another edition of the Online Learning Podcast. So that's it for another episode of the Online Learning Podcast. Don't forget, you can get all the show notes at my website, jbdcolley.com. Just put in OLP and then the number of the episode. I really appreciate you spending time with me today. Please pop over to iTunes if you've got a minute and leave a comment and a rating. And I look forward to seeing you very soon again in another edition of the Online Learning Podcast.